Len was faintly roused by the church bells and lay still, lingering with his sleep, his eyes closed and his thoughts unshaped. As he became slowly aware of the morning, the ringing and the light reached him, and he waked wholly and considered the strange room filled with the bells and the sun of the winter's day. "Where have I struck now?" he inquired. And as last night returned abruptly upon his mind, he raised himself on his arm. There sat Responsibility in a chair, washed clean and dressed, watching him.
"You're awfully late," said Responsibility. "But I weren't a-going without telling you goodbye."
"Go?
Go where? You surely ain't leaving me to eat breakfast alone."
The cowpuncher made his voice very plaintive. Set Responsibility free after all his trouble to catch him? This was more than he could do.
"I've got to go. If I'd thought you'd want me to stay, why, you said you was a-going by the early train."
"But the darn thing got away on me."
"If I hadn't a promised them..."
"Who?"
"Sidney Ellis and Pete Good. Why, you know them. You grub with them."
"Shucks.
We're going to have fun today."
"Ah,
for it's Christmas, and we bought some good cigars. And Pete says he'll learn me, sure. But I'd just as lief stayed with you if I'd only knowed sooner. I wish you lived here. Do you smoke whole big cigars when you was beginning?"
"Do you like flapjacks and maple syrup?"
inquired the artful McLean.
"That's what I'm figuring on inside 20 minutes.
20 minutes? If they'd wait.
"See here, Bill. They've quit expecting you, don't you think? I'd ought to waked, you see, but I slept and kept you from meeting your engagements, you see. For you couldn't go, of course. A man couldn't treat a man that way now, could he?"
"Of course he could.
And they wouldn't wait, you see. They wouldn't fool away Christmas that only come once a year, kicking their heels and saying, 'Where's Billy?' They'd say, 'Bill has sure made other arrangements, which he'll explain to us at his leisure,' and they skipped with the cigars."
The advocate paused, effectively, and from his bolster regarded Billy with a convincing eye.
"That's so. And where would you be then, Bill? In the street, out of friends, and out of Christmas, and left both ways. No tobacker and no flapjacks. Now, Bill, what do you say to us putting up a Christmas deal together? Just you and me."
"I'd like that. Is it all day?"
"I was thinking of all day. I'll not make you do anything you'd rather not."
"Ah, they can smoke without me. I'll see 'em tomorrow."
"That's you! Now, Bill, you hustle down and tell them to keep a table for us. I'll get my clothes on and follow you."
The boy went, and Mr. McLean procured hot water and dressed himself, tying his scarf with great care. He picked up the arrowhead and the kinnikinnick, and was particular to store them in his safest pocket.
"I ain't sure whether you're crazy or not," said he to the man in the looking-glass. "I ain't never been sure."
And he slammed the door and went downstairs. He found young Bill on guard over a table for four, with all the chairs tilted against it as warning to strangers. No one sat at any other table or came into the room, for it was late. Len provided a thorough meal, and Billy pronounced the flannel cakes superior to flapjacks, which were not upon the bill of fare.
"I'd like to see you often. I'll come and see you if you don't live too far."
"That's trouble. I do. Awful far."
"Well, I might come sometime. I wish you'd write me a letter. Can you write?"
"What's that? Can I write? Oh, yes.
I can write. And I can read, too. I've been to school in Sidney, Nebraska, and Magog, Kansas, and Salt Lake. That's the finest town except Denver."
Billy fell into that cheerful strain of comment, which, unreplied to, yet goes on contented and self-sustaining, while Mr. McLean gave amiable signs of assent, but chiefly looked out of the window. And when the now interested waiter said respectfully that he desired to close the room, they went out to the office, where the money was got out of the safe and the bill paid. The streets were full of the bright sun, and seemingly at Denver's gates stood the mountains sparkling. An air, crisp and pleasant, wafted from their peaks, and presently through the town the bells broke out against the jocund silence of the morning.
"Don't you like music?"
"Yes," said Lynn.
Ladies with their husbands and children were passing and meeting, and the salutations of Christmas came now and again to the cowpuncher's ears. But today, possessor of his own share in this, Lynn looked at everyone with a sort of friendly challenge, and young Billy talked along beside him.
"Don't you think we could go in here?"
The church door was open, and the rich organ sounded through the pavement.
"They've got good music in here, and they keep it up without much talking between. I've been in lots of times."
They went in and sat to hear the music. Better than the organ, it seemed to them, were the harmonious voices raised from somewhere outside, and the pair sat in their back seat, too deep in listening to the processional hymn to think of rising in decent imitation of those around them. The crystal melody of the refrain especially reached their understandings.
"Shout the glad tidings, exultingly sing, Jerusalem triumphs, Messiah is King, Messiah is King, Messiah is King."
And when, for the fourth time, "Shout the glad tidings, exultingly sing," pealed forth and ceased, both the delighted faces fell.
"Don't you wish there was more? Wish there was 100 verses."
But the canticles and responses followed. With so little talking between them, they were held spellbound, seldom thinking to rise or kneel. Lynn's eyes roved over the church, dwelling upon the pillars in their evergreen, the flowers and leafy wreaths, the texts of white and gold.
"Peace, goodwill toward men," he read. "That's so. Peace and goodwill. Yes, that's so. I expect they got that somewheres in the Bible. It's awful good, and you'd never think of it yourself."
There was a touch on his arm, and a woman handed a book to him.
"This is the hymn we have now," she whispered gently.
And Lynn, blushing scarlet, took it passively without a word. He and Billy stood up and held the book together, dutifully reading the words, "It came upon the midnight clear," that glorious song of old, from angels bending near the earth to touch their harps of gold. This tune was more beautiful than all, and Lynn lost himself in it, until he found Billy recalling him with a finger upon the words, the concluding ones, "And the whole world sent back the song which now the angels sing." The music rose and descended to its lovely and simple end, and for a second time in Denver, Lynn brushed a hand across his eyes. He turned his face from his neighbor, frowning crossly, and since the heart had reasons which reason does not know, he seemed to himself a fool. But when the service was over and he came out, he repeated again,
"Peace and goodwill. When I run on to the Bishop of Wyoming, I'll tell him if he'll preach on them words, I'll be there." "Couldn't we shoot your pistol now?" "Sure, boy. Ain't you hungry, though?"
"No. I wish we were away off up there, don't you?"
"The mountains? They look pretty so white, a heap better than houses." "Why, we'll go there. There's trains to Golden. We'll shoot around among the foothills."
To Golden they immediately went, and after a meal there, wandered in the open country until the cartridges were gone. The sun was low, and Billy was walked off his young heels, a truth he learned complete in one horrid moment and battled to conceal.
"Lame? I ain't." "Shucks, you are, and both feet. Tell you, there's stones here, and I'm just a-skipping them."
Lynn took the boy in his arms and carried him to Golden.
"I'm played out myself," he said, sitting in the hotel and looking lugubriously at Billy on a bed, "and I ain't fit to have charge of a hog."
He came and put his hand on the boy's head.
"I'm not sick," said the cripple. "I tell you, I'm bully. You wait and see me eat dinner."
But Lynn had hot water and cold water and salt and was an hour upon his knees bathing the hot feet. And then Billy could not eat dinner. There was a doctor in Golden, but in spite of his light prescription and most reasonable observations, Mr. McLean passed a foolish night of vigil while Billy slept, quite well at first, and, as the hours passed, better and better. In the morning he was entirely brisk, though stiff.
"I couldn't work quick today," he said, "but I guess one day wouldn't lose me my trade."
"How do you mean?" asked Lynn.
Well, I got regulars, you know. Sidney Ellis and Pete Good has theirs, and we don't cut each other. I've got Mr. Daniels and Mr. Fisher and lots. And if you lived in Denver, I'd shine your boots every day for nothing. I wish you lived in Denver. Shine my boots? You'll never. And you don't black Daniels or Fisher or any of the outfit. Why, I'm doing first rate, said Billy, surprised at the swearing into which Mr. McLean now burst. And I ain't big enough to get to make money at any other job. I want to see that engine man, and I don't like your smoking friend. Pete Good? Why, he's awful smart. Don't you think he's smart? Smart's nothing. Pete has learned me and Sidney a lot. I'll bet he has.
It was not so simple, this case. To the perturbed mind of Mr. McLean, it grew less simple during the day at Golden while Billy recovered and talked. The cowpuncher was far too wise to think for a single moment of restoring the runaway to his debauched and shiftless parents. Possessed of some imagination, he went through a scene in which he appeared at the lust threshold with Billy and forgiveness.
Shucks, that kid would be off again inside a week, and I don't want him there anyway.
Denver, upon the following day, saw the little bootblack again at his corner with his trade not lost. But near him stood a tall, singular man with hazel eyes and a sulky expression. And citizens during that week noticed, as a new sight in the streets, the tall man and the little boy walking together. Sometimes they would be in shops. The boy seemed as happy as possible, talking constantly, while the man seldom said a word and his face was serious. Upon New Year's Eve, Governor Barker was overtaken by Mr. McLean riding a horse up Hill Street, Cheyenne. "Hello," said Barker, staring humorously through his glasses. "Have a good drunk?"
"Changed my mind," said Lynn, grinning. "Proves I got one. Struck Christmas all right, though."
"Who's your friend?" inquired His Excellency.
"This is Mr. Billy Lusk. Him and me have agreed that towns ain't nice to live in. If Judge Henry's foreman and his wife won't board him at Sunk Creek, why, I'll fix it somehow."
The cowpuncher and his responsibility rode on together toward the open plain.
"Suffering Moses," remarked His Excellency.